out what impacts these different projects may have on your guys' rates. So we'll start with the sanitary sewer system flow study. Basically, we kind of did, we had to do a little bit of homework on the system itself, just figure out exactly what we have here and who we're serving and some theoretical quantities. Basically, we've determined you guys serve about 1,158 single family residential, 30 commercial properties, and 14 multifamily properties. That's assessed really solely from aerial imagery and trying to identify properties. The majority of the existing collection system was constructed in the 1970s. We talked about that at the plant. The plant was constructed with the majority of the existing system. And your system is comprised of about 80,000 feet of gravity sewer, 3,000 feet of force main, and 6 sanitary sewer lift stations. Does not include the Unity High, Junior High lift station, which they own and maintain and they pump into your system. The existing treatment plant we're just at, located on South Bourne, it's an activated sludge plant and originally constructed in the early 1970s with the collection system. There were some upgrades in the 80s, 84, I believe. They added primary clarifier, the filter building, and some sludge in the sludge storage lagoon. And then in 2011, they added the roughing filter on top of the primary clarifier to help enhance the treatment there. So lift stations, we went through and did visual assessments and some drawdown tests on this stuff, just to try to identify if a lift station has condition or capacity concerns, because they're kind of critical points in this system that can be bottlenecks if they are not operating. So Elizabeth Street, we determined it's in fair condition. There's some confined space entry concerns because right now it's a can type lift station where all your controls and everything are, you know, 15, 20 feet underground. So it requires a manned entry to go down and do that stuff, which basically you, if you do it right, it takes 2 to 3 people to do this with some additional equipment every time you need to get in there. Watson Street, the same way, fair condition, confined space entry concerns. Right now, those are both, like I said, they're operational. They just have some safety concerns with them, and I know Elizabeth Street has had some clogging concerns based on what ERH proposed on last year. Third Street, it's in fair condition. There's signs of force main corrosion in the wet well, but nothing serious right now. Larman Street is in fair condition. Again, some signs of corrosion on the guide rails and brackets, but overall in decent shape. East Street lift station was a little alarming. We opened it. Extremely poor condition, primarily because the components within this wet well. The wet well was originally a sewage ejector pump station that was a dry pit that they turned into a wet pit, and basically all of the components have reached a point of corrosion that are pretty poor, which I'll go back a second just to show you this picture I have here on the cover. That's the guide rail that's the crossbar that's holding the guide rails down to the pumps. And you can basically poke your finger through that if you want. If that goes down, then there's no telling what's gonna be operational at that point. So the station itself is also metal, which we're proposing to replace with a concrete structure. With an H2S inhibitor in it. Condit Street is your newest one. It's up there by Deer Path. It's in good condition. There's some signs of groundwater infiltration in the wet well that you could repair to just cut down on some of that. But overall, everything that's really good. It's 15 years old-ish, I think. Operational concerns. So we did drawdown tests on all of these lift stations, which essentially defines how they're operating. We just do a physical test to say, okay, this one's pumping at 200 GPM, this one's pumping at this, and then compare that to the upstream theoretical capacity of what it should be taking and if it can handle it. Essentially, with the exception of Larman Street, there was no capacity concerns everywhere. Everything that was in place is of adequate capacity to handle the flows that are coming to it. Larman Street, however, it operates surcharge, so we couldn't run a drawdown on it. And surcharge basically just means that the manhole itself is backed up and it's backed up into the sewer system, so there's no way of quantifying what the on-off levels are actually pumping to determine a flow rate on that. And then again, the operator expressed concerns with clogging at Elizabeth Street, which I think ERH gave you a proposal to replace with chopper pumps last year. Larman Street, we didn't mess with anything because sometimes they're set up a certain way because of downstream capacity issues, so we didn't touch it, but it should probably be looked at a little bit further to see if that's just maybe some alteration of the float switches that operate the pump station that need to be set so that basically your sewer pipes are getting backed up. If your sewer pipes are getting back into the water, solids can start settling out with them, and then eventually it could create a backup further upstream. Wastewater treatment assessments, the plant shows significant signs of age and deterioration, spalling concrete and corroded mechanical components and piping. The influent lift station appears to be undersized based on what we could tell at the time. The flow into it was constantly surcharging the upstream. There's an east and west interceptor that come into that point, and they were regularly surcharged during operation. I think that's primarily the pump. The pump itself cannot keep up to force it up there, which then the stormwater pump kicks on and pumps it over to the excess flow lagoon more often than it probably needs to. Operational concerns, couldn't perform the drawdown test to define exactly what the pumps are pumping at. So the pumps may be undersized is kind of our initial reaction there. The village's aggregated water usage and the what we saw for average daily flow based on the plant size, they're very close to each other, which makes us believe that the data is good. Multiple treatment processes are part of the plant process design are not operated, which would be kind of the filters. We went to the filter building, they're not operating right now. The chlorine contact tanks not operating, the sludge drying beds. There's a lot of components that are kind of excess right now that aren't being operated that could be more useful space, the chemical storage area. Basically, as part of this study, it was really just kind of a general visual and operational assessment, not really defining what water quality was being treated, so which got handled as part of the next study. So when we were trying to figure out where we had flow concerns and stuff, put these monitors out, basically had to delineate the system to try to, you don't want to put a monitor every 100 feet because it would be excessively expensive, but you also don't want to put it on each end of town because it's not going to necessarily tell you where some isolated concerns are. So we went through and delineated it based on where the lift stations were and then further delineated to six basins, which we thought was reasonable, trying to take this about the same amount of gravity sewer from each one that we could evaluate as part of this. Due to some poor monitoring flow conditions in certain mantles that we wanted to put them in, we either put them in or we relocated them shortly after we realized that the data was not good in those locations. These were our flow monitoring locations. We had basically two down by the plant, which one was the west interceptor, one was the east interceptor. We had Elizabeth Street, which was kind of smack dab in the middle, lower part of the green section. We had Washington Street, which is upstream of that, takes the blue area and then additional north green area. And then we had, on the west side of town, we had Watson Street, which is right there by the, FS gas station there. And then we had another one that kind of, we tried to bisect that orange and blue area so that we were getting more of an even split. And that one was on Corey Street. Okay, so basically summary, we monitored for 3 months from March 14th to June 19th. The average dry weather during the flow study corresponded very well to your water usage data within about 10%, so made us kind of validated the data for us to make sure we were actually getting things that were reasonable. Peak storm event occurred on March 30th, and it was after a couple other days of rain events, so ground conditions were saturated. We were going to see some higher flows. And then no single event during the storm, no single storm exceeded a two-month reoccurrence, which basically indicates that although it was a pretty good storm, you're probably going to see bigger storms and larger flows than what we even experienced during this study. Based on the data collected, it appears that approximately a third of the total water pumped and treated by the village could be related to groundwater infiltration or stormwater inflow, which does seem like a lot, but it's not as bad as it seems. So infiltration is groundwater getting in through leaky joints of manholes, sewer pipes, things like that. And just essentially it's water that doesn't need to be treated that you guys are paying to treat via electrical bills and operations and maintenance and wear and tear on the equipment. Basically, if it's left unmonitored, it can have severely negative effects, you know, including surcharging your system, property damage from backing up in people's basements, or, you know, increased operational costs from excessive pumping or electrical to run your sewage plant for these flows that don't need to be treated. As you can see, basically the West Side Interceptor area yielded the highest observed groundwater infiltration percentage, followed by the Watson Street area and the Elizabeth Street area. The one thing to point out, though, is none of these are necessarily considered excessive by EPA's rule of thumb, which if we were seeing something that was like 3,000 gallons per day per inch diameter of main or per inch diameter mile of sewer that you're seeing, that's kind of a general rule of thumb for assuming that this is excessive groundwater. All sewer systems end up getting groundwater in them. It's not a perfect thing, so that's kind of their rule of thumb. So basically what we came out of this was the infiltration, there was nowhere in the system that had what we would consider an excessive amount of infiltration at this point. There are some for concerns, you know, the higher numbers are going to be ones that maybe if you're going to try to pinpoint those would be places to focus your dollars in doing so. Inflow is more related to anything that's not sanitary sewer flow that's getting in the system. The storm sewer cross-connection over to that, people's basement drains connected into the sewer system, sump pumps, things like that. You know, in comparison of the peak hourly flow to the average dry weather flow is defined as a peaking factor. Higher peaking factors can potentially indicate that you have higher rates of inflow in those areas. As you can see here, Washington Street area yielded the highest peaking factor, and then Watson Street was second again, and then East Street Interceptor was third. However, again, this was not considered excessive as far as the whole system goes. EPA's rule of thumb for that is if you're seeing more than 275 gallons per person per day, it is maybe considered that you have excessive inflow somewhere in your system. You guys, even not even at, with the average, but just considering this peak event, we were only at 222. So at this time, inflow is not necessarily considered excessive. The Washington Street area, I know just from looking at the East Street lift station, we did notice there's some kind of cross connection, possibly a drain tile or something over there. Water was running constantly when we opened one of the manholes over there, which that may be the contributor there to Washington Street. A lot of times these things are, you know, a few isolated things that are producing 90% of this kind of stuff, but tracking it down is the hard part. So our conclusions, as far as the collection system flow study goes, although the groundwater infiltration and stormwater inflow they're present here and they seem like a big deal right now, they're not excessive anywhere in the system. It's not some number that's crazy. And the financial impacts of that, when we looked at that, treating this excess flow don't necessarily warrant spending money to try to go out and find and reduce these at this point. One thing that we would advise would basically be doing just an annual cleaning, televising of your sewers. EPA recommends it's a best management practice. A lot of people, you know, it's hard to afford to do as EPA says something like, I don't know, once every 2 years or 3 years, I think, is the recommendation, but most people can't afford that. So, you know, we think probably a reasonable goal would be maybe getting 10% of your system a year, which would be about 8,000 feet, which right now corresponds to about $28,000 a year. And that's basically going and cleaning your gravity sewers. You could pick the worst ones in the worst areas to try to focus on. Clean them, inspect them, check out the videos. You may have a few spot repairs that you can get to before they become big issues. And then that way, every 10 years, you're at least looking at every part of your system a little bit to make sure that there's no major issues. Again, inspection should be focused in probably your oldest infrastructure areas as well as the areas that were identified as having, you know, higher groundwater infiltration or inflow rates from the report. The other big thing that came out of this was due to the condition, we recommended East Street Lift Station be replaced as soon as possible, which right now we are currently out to permit with IEPA for that and intend to bid that come early next year or late this year, I think, at this point. Elizabeth Street Lift Station and Watson Street, basically there were not operational concerns there right now, maybe some clogging at Elizabeth Street where you guys looked at doing some pumps, but basically that we may want to look at rehab or replacement to eliminate some of the safety concerns with the confined space entry on that one. So right now, essentially, you guys don't have major inflow infiltration concerns yet. Yes, you're paying a little bit more to treat this stuff, but it's not necessarily worth, you know, putting a planned approach together. That I think your inspections, if you guys do implement the annual inspections here, you're going to identify spot repairs and things like that as you go that will need to be done. And as far as the wastewater treatment goes out of this study, you know, basically the flow capacity is a concern. Based on what we saw, you know, we were seeing higher daily average flows than what the plant's rated for currently. Not that it's inundated, because they have a pretty significant excess flow storage right now, but very regularly, you guys are seeing flows up to 40% beyond your daily average. Basically, out of this, we recommend performing a little bit more detailed analysis of the wastewater treatment plant, which is our next study. Are there any questions about this so far? Mm-hmm. All right, I'll turn it over to Terry, let him talk about the treatment plant. All right.
So we looked at your wastewater plant. So a couple of the key goals and purposes were, you're looking at extending service to a couple adjacent developments. As Tim just mentioned, you know, based on the sewer study, there's a lot of extra flow coming into the treatment plant. So we wanted to look at what the impact was to the treatment plant. And then basically because of the age and because of the condition and because of, you know, in the future, you're going to see changing regulations. And now's the time to start thinking about, you know, what's going to need to happen there. So just to, obviously we just walked out there, but here's an aerial view of the treatment plant. And so I won't go over all these, but basically, you know, primary treatment, secondary treatment, the stormwater equalization basin, and then the sludge storage lagoon are your main components there. This just shows a little bit more blown up view of it with the aeration basins and final clarifiers. So everything was built, you know, in that box with the aeration basins, aerobic digesters, clarifiers, you know, one big concrete box, and everything's kind of subdivided in there. And that concrete is getting deteriorated over time. So that's a big concern. Obviously, you saw the equipment out there, piping, valves. It's well-worn, well-used. Skip on to this one. As Tim alluded to, this is the flow information for the treatment plant. So when we say at the top there, the DAF, that's design average flow. So that's what the treatment plant was designed for, that 235,000 gallons a day. Currently, the DMF means design maximum flow. So the current, and that was, can't read that from here, 588. And currently, you're flowing much higher than your design average flow and your design maximum flow. If we tack onto that the expected flows from new developments, so that's another, you know, 44,000 gallons a day, and then growth of 65,000 gallons a day, and then the additional population growth. So all that totals up to an expected capacity in the future of 500,000 gallons a day. So a little bit more than double what your treatment plant capacity is right now. And then your design maximum flow, again, would go up to that 1 million gallon a day range, up from that 588,000. So the developments that were being looked at for future incorporation, the Oaks Mobile Home Park, the Unity West Elementary School, and then some residential commercial properties between the Oaks and the school. So just, and then the other future developments, the extension to the Mobile Home Park, and then I'm not sure what the last three bullet points there were.
Okay, so basically the additional residential development near Uni West, basically there's some land there. If that ever expanded, it would likely be residential. Then there's been discussions of some residential development over by Eastside Park, a small parcel of land, which I believe is already in your guys' city limits. And then the additional residential development to the west of Village Hall over there, I believe Woodworth property is the one that I hear that there's been talks about development over there at some point as well.
So this was the you know, the key takeaway from the sewer study, the 40% over the original design number. And then we went through and looked at each of your main treatment processes through the treatment plant. And so what this is showing is that, so for the primary clarifiers, we have two vertical bars there. One is your current operation, and the green one is for future expansion. And then the red line across is just 100% of capacity, so, you know, it would be, and then the orange line, you can't really read it on the slide here, but that's 80%. And the 80% just represents where Illinois EPA would have a concern and put you on critical review if you exceed 80% capacity, and then adding more customers onto the treatment plant would become a problem or a challenge with them. You'd have to be justified a lot. So the primary clarifiers are just over 80% now at their current loading. And then in the future, we'd be approaching 100%. The roughing filter itself is already overloaded. It's beyond its capacity. Same with the aeration basins are way overloaded. The final clarifiers are getting to that 80% level. The chlorine contact tank, while you don't have to use it right now, it could be something you might need to use in the future. That's also approaching, it's over 80% now and approaching 100% with the development. And then the aerobic digesters are undersized as well. So everything is kind of in need of additional capacity at the treatment plant. So what we looked at when we did this preliminary evaluation was we looked at the original design numbers for the treatment plant. So the BOD, that's the measure of the organic strength of the wastewater. So that stands for biological oxygen demand. That's just how strong it is. The TSS stands for total suspended solids. That's basically the settable solids that come into the treatment plant. Ammonia and phosphorus are just other concern items that are regulated in your permit. Ammonia is, phosphorus will be likely in the future. Because we had limited good data that we could get from the treatment plant on what's actually coming into the wastewater plant, we use those design numbers. Those may be pretty conservative based on actual, some of the dilution factor you have because of the inflow into the system. So we had a little bit of data, so you can see that 134 and that 154. So those are significantly lower than the design numbers. We didn't take the time or have the time to go through and spend a lot of additional dollars trying to collect more data to determine what are the actual influent concentrations. So we used as a preliminary step the design numbers. When we go to next steps, we should do a much more comprehensive data sampling and analysis to make sure we see where the real capacities are and what we're needing to design to. So these are what's required in the permit. On the left side there is what your main outfall, so that's through the treatment process itself. You have those limits for BOD and TSS, and then ammonia, and then DO. What you'll notice on here is that under the fecal coliform row, it says monitor only, and the same with total phosphorus. Fecal coliform just means that because you monitor only, you don't have to disinfect. So that's the chlorine contact tank that's not being used right now. You have a disinfection exemption based on where you discharge to. It's a rural drainage ditch without any human contact possibility there. So most likely that will remain. However, in the state of Illinois, they are going to a lot of places and taking away disinfection exemptions. So that's something that just to be watchful for in the permit. Draft permits that come out, if that shows up as a compliance schedule for disinfection, we have fought that, and it helps you not have to do that based on nothing's changed on your receiving stream to warrant it. The other one, the outfall 002, is the excess flow. There are times when extended rain events, you cannot get everything back into the treatment plant and you're still pushing flow over there, so it will overflow. But you have a permitted discharge with certain limits there. And so that third bullet point just indicates that in the future with total phosphorus or with disinfection, there may be limits coming down the road. Phosphorus is kind of a known quantity that by 2035, they would like all treatment plants in the state of Illinois to be treating for phosphorus down to a very low level. So you will fall into that at some point. And then ammonia limits are another thing the state of Illinois is really trying to ratchet down on. So they're looking at cutting those down in half, again, just because of the acute toxicity to the aquatic environment from ammonia. So that's those things are coming down the road. And that kind of played into how we looked at your treatment plan and potential options for future improvements. The things that we identified that are kind of concerning, there are a lot of items there that are just quickly approaching the end of their useful life. So the inflow pumps, the stormwater pump, the blowers, I know you just had one rebuilt, the clarifier mechanisms, and most of the valves and metering are beyond their useful life. There are the ones I just mentioned in the second bullet point that are undersized for capacity of primary clarifiers, aeration basins, secondary clarifiers, aerobic digestion. And then we have some code and compliance concerns. The ventilation is much better. Ventilation is needed in that lower area where the blowers and pumps are. Right now that's considered a class one, division two space. I think we have another slide coming up on what NFPA 820 is. So it's an electrical code requirement for wastewater treatment plants. Concrete repairs are needed, and then anytime we're at a treatment plant, we're always concerned about safety of people walking around. We walked on the gratings. One of the grating stairs, slipped when we were out there. That should be clipped down to make sure that kind of stuff doesn't happen. And so those kind of things are of a concern that it should be walked through and then corrected. NFPA 20, so NFPA just stands for National Fire Protection Act. There's a code 820 for wastewater treatment plants, National Fire Protection Association. Kind of read my own bullet points. So the 820 just defines what needs to be done in wastewater treatment plants. A lot of times you don't have this situation, but at any treatment plant, you could have hazardous gases. So coming into the wastewater treatment plant, that inflow wet well could have H2S. That's a hazardous gas. It could migrate and be an issue. Some treatment plants have flammable gases, which are methane. That can also result in any of your primary tanks or your raw sewage wet well. In your particular case, the very last bullet point is class one div two location within the blower and pump area is one thing that we should correct. And we do that by just adding ventilation, a continuous airflow of six air changes per hour, and that derates the space from a class one division two to an unrated space then. So that's a pretty simple thing to do. In all of the recommended alternatives we looked at, we are considering keeping that pump area like it is. We would upgrade the pumps, but you already have the wet well there. It's infrastructure we can reuse. We don't see any need to go create a whole new pump station, for that. So I won't go through all these in detail because basically we're saying you need to upgrade almost everything at the treatment plant. That's what we just walked out and looked at. So there's a lot of recommended upgrades. So what we looked at were two major things. One, just upgrade everything that's there now. But our big challenge would be twofold. One is you don't have capacity in a lot of the treatment processes, so you have to try to add concrete to existing concrete. The other bullet point was to look at, adding a new treatment facility that would take care of the existing flows and loadings, as well as some of the future nutrient removal concerns for ammonia and phosphorus and total nitrogen. And so those were the treatment systems that we evaluated down there. There were six different things that we took a look at to see what would seem to make the most sense for your facility. So the first one is the one that we actually recommended in our report to you. It's an oxidation ditch. It appears that it would fit in to the east side of the filter building. And if we need to reclaim space from the filter building, we could potentially demo that and get that out of the way. We're gonna be able to fit on the site. This is a very simple operation. So Tuscola has an oxidation ditch. It's very effective for nutrient removal. It's because of the way that it operates, it's very energy efficient as well. And because we run those with a lot of bugs in it, we can minimize shock loading. So if you have an industrial concern or somebody that ends up sending you something that's too strong, there's a lot of biomass there to take care of it. So there is a you know, requirement for space, and it's, you know, not insignificant dollars, you know, to make this improvement at $5.6 million. The other one we looked at was a sequencing batch reactor. The hope was, when I first was thinking about this, that's a small, theoretically a smaller treatment facility. These operate without secondary clarifiers. So if you see here, the two circles on the right are secondary clarifiers to settle the sludge. Here you settle the sludge within the reaction basin. You just turn off the air and let it settle. And so that's always the hope, is that we can find some cost savings for concrete. However, these are really deep. In order to work, you need that volume there. So because of the depth, the cost exceeded what the oxygenation ditch cost was. So again, these are pretty simple operation. For a while there, they were out of favor with Illinois EPA because of not great operational controls. Now our instrumentation and control systems got so much more advanced than 20 years ago that these are being put in again in Illinois. So the other thing we looked at, we thought maybe we could get a really nice, compact, and very, very clean effluent out of the system by using a membrane bioreactor. So it's a small footprint, and then it uses membranes to physically separate. So we don't have the clarifiers to settle solids. We use a membrane, we draw the water through it, the solids stay in, and we waste out occasionally. So it's a nice system. The one thing I liked about it was that if something happens and the sludge doesn't want to settle, which can happen sometimes, so we get a bulking sludge, we have an upset, and the sludge just wants to float and not settle, well, you don't have an issue with the membranes, because it's a physical system that separates the solids. So we were hoping this would be a nice, clean solution to fit in, but the membranes are just so expensive. You know, so you can see that's a $7 million price tag, and then you have a significant more amount of energy. You have to worry about, too, that 7 to 10, maybe 12 years from now, you have to replace the membranes, and that's a big cost. So that one didn't really pan out. The other thought was looking at just the traditional package plant. So St. Joe is a St. Joseph is a community that has package plants, and all these do is put a clarifier in the middle and all your treatments around it. It's a pretty common small treatment plant process. Did one of these in Findlay. Again, though, because of the amount of concrete you need, and it's getting tight on the space there between your excess flow clarifier, it just, the cost was a little bit higher than the oxidation ditch. And then we had some discussions. I know Algae Wheel has been in talking and looking at potentially an algae wheel system. This is a different way of doing the treatment using algae. They don't make systems this big yet. So we talked to them. They were uncomfortable providing us a quotation, and we would have been uncomfortable designing a system that's their first, you know, this large. So, and then the last one was, I had a hope that we could get away with the lagoon system and go to something really simple for y'all, so that you don't have to worry about, you know, equipment and clarifiers and settling. So Lemtech makes a lagoon system that's completely covered, and you want it completely covered mainly because of the ammonia removal. So that's what they were offering, is a completely covered lagoon, and keep the temperature up so the bugs work to remove ammonia. And then we polish it after with another small polishing reactor to help remove the residual ammonia that's still there. They're using these in very cold climates up in northern Minnesota, up into Canada. So my goal in thinking about this was just to make it a really simple operation. You just pump into this, you don't worry about sludge until 15, 20 years down the road, and you decide to clean out the lagoon. You make them big enough that they can accumulate that volume of sludge at the bottom of the lagoon, you just don't worry about it. So, but you can see how much space it takes up. So not only your existing excess flow basin that's there now, but significant additional space to the south there, which I'm not even sure is property you have any ability to obtain at all. So, yeah, at the end of the day, we recommended the oxidation ditch for the reasons I mentioned, and
is that the most energy efficient too? With that,
yes,
one?
Because of the way it operates with the discs, they put air in a certain spot, let the flow go down, the air kind of gets used up. So then the bugs use nitrate, so the ammonia gets converted to nitrate, The bugs then use the nitrate for their oxidative purposes, and then we go to the next set of brushes, put more air in. So it makes that kind of alternating loop back and forth, so that's how they save a bunch of energy. And it gets you total nitrogen removal without really having to have a complicated system.
What about phosphates?
Phosphorus, so part of that, we'll move on that thing is, yeah, we put an anaerobic tank ahead of it. So the anaerobic tank, we didn't really call it out. I guess it's called out on the more descriptive one to the left. So that's an anaerobic tank. And what we do there is we actually create a condition where the bugs in the wastewater are accumulating. They need the phosphorus, right, to just live, right? We all need phosphorus. So when the bugs come through that anaerobic tank, we cut off all air, there's no oxygen, and the bugs release phosphorus. And they get conditioned when they come back into the aerated zone to take up about 4 to 5 times their normal mass of phosphorus as a biological. So it's a biological phosphorus removal. So yeah, this would be set up for phosphorus removal. In the future, the goal from the state of Illinois is to have you at a 0.5 annual geometric mean. And they will not require you to put in chemical phosphorus removal as backup. So right now, if we do a design, it's a 1 milligram per liter monthly average, and we're typically being conservative and put in backup chemical facilities. For the annual geometric mean, that squishes out those outliers that, you know, impact the average, but not the geometric mean. So you would be much more comfortable doing it without a chemical addition. So that's why it's set up like this, to help save chemical as well as energy costs. Any other questions? All right, I'll let Tim talk to you about the money.
All right, so, you know, we looked at basically your guys' existing financials over the last 4 fiscal years, including this year as the 5th year for your budget to revenues and expenses. We identified that your current water reserves at the end of last year were just about $1.5 million there. And based on the needs that we had projected over this stuff, just for ballparking some of the stuff for the time being, we split those reserves out as 20% for water, 80% for sewer, just to try to identify where our rates really need to be in using those up. So for the water fund, the expenses and rate structure, this is your past 5 years, including this year's budgeted amounts. The line I would point to would be the red line there, that over the last 5 years you've operated at a loss every year, so you've been dipping into reserves of some sort to make sure you're able to pay for your expenses. And you can see then your rates at the bottom of the screen there. You guys have made some impacts to your rates. I think it was a long time until you did, and then it looks like 2018 is where you guys started making some additional rate adjustments to try to remedy some of the loss that you guys were operating under. And then this one is your sewer fund expenses and rate structure. Same idea here. I should state that I kind of simplified your guys' budgets and rates down into these 5 or 6 categories so that we didn't have a 70-item list of expenses. But again, you can see there in the red, you guys were operating at a loss on your sewer fund the last 5 years, very close to even on 2019, it looks like there. But again, you guys, 2018, it looks like you guys started to make some adjustments to that to start increasing that to fight that, which worked for 2019. Right now, you guys are budgeted, you know, much higher, but that's also taking into account the East Street lift station right now, that if that were all constructed in this year, that's where you'd be. If you're able to split that over a couple fiscal years, it doesn't look so bad. So this is a question that always comes up. Everyone wants to know what your neighbors are paying. It's not necessarily always representative, but I did do a little bit of research just so we could talk about it. You know, the big thing here, I don't like to tout this. Yes, it's a decent measuring point, but everybody's operating different systems. You know, some people operate water treatment with their water system, whereas you guys just operate your water system and pay for the treatment. You're really paying for it one way or another, but all the systems take different efforts to run. Basically, what I've used for this rate study is about 4,000 gallons a month. If you EPA standards, they say when you're budgeting for new sewer systems, 350 gallons per single family residential home per day is kind of like the high number. More realistically, most families of four are maybe operating closer to that 4,000 gallons per month range. Basically, what we see here is the mean average monthly user cost for water service in the adjacent communities, not including Tolono, would be about $39.84 a month for 4,000 gallons, which is about 28% higher than Tolono's current average user rates at 4,000 gallons a month. And the mean average sewer service for the adjacent communities listed above is about $38.53 per month, which is about 75% higher than Tolono's average rates at 4,000 gallons per month. You guys want to look at that a little bit longer or not. Philo and Sydney don't have sewer, so they weren't included on the sewer side, but they did have water, and they are fairly close neighbors of size and economic status. So here's just a bar chart of the water rates stacked up against each other. That 39.84 there is the mean average between all the other communities. And then you guys can see here that you guys are about 28% lower than that currently in 2020, or fiscal 2020. And then here's the bar chart for the sewer. Again, Phil and Sydney don't have sewer, so they weren't included here, but you can see you guys are about 75% lower. I will state Homer did, they're much higher than most, but they just built their sewer system a few years ago, but they also got 50%-ish grant funds, if not more. It might have been 75%. So they got a ton of assistance on that, and you guys are going to be looking down the barrel of some of those similar-sized improvements. So some of the capital projects that we identified for the near future upcoming, I sat down with Matt. We've got a couple already on the list for the water system. And the Broadway and Reynolds water main, that's the one we bid out last year, didn't award it due to budget constraints. Basically, pretty immediate need. I think Matt said you guys had another break on that somewhat recently. Just need to get that main out of service. Vorsey, Leedy, Clifford, Bourne are also another area Matt identified as having some concerns about. I believe that's a 4-inch main that's undersized there as well. Then Meadow Lane, water main looping, getting pretty regular complaints when school's out at the Oaks, I believe. And I talked about possibly looping Meadow Lane up to the Oaks so that we have a loop provided through there and that water is actually turning over. And then miscellaneous hydrant valve replacements. This is a lot of systems, they have non-operable hydrants or valves that they don't know about because typically you don't have the manpower to go exercise these things every year. So we just kind of generally budgeted for about 40 hydrant or valve replacements sometime in the next 15 years. And those would be just spot replacements. Typically those are running you about $5,000 if someone has to come in and actually replace a hydrant or valve because a lot of the valving, quite frankly, just doesn't operate to a point that you can shut it down and actually get into the stuff, so they have to either do line stops or some kind of special injection valves to stop the flow to put these things in or tap the mains. And then number five there, this is just more general. I looked at based on your overall system, estimated the amount of pipe and service line and stuff that you guys operate based on its age, you know, the majority of the system could be very old. We're not really sure how old the main is, but a lot of replacements were done in the 60s and 70s that we found plans from. So I would guess the majority of your system is probably 50 years old or older. But based on that and, you know, typical life expectancy of these things and whatnot, came up with a budget about $230,000 biannually starting in 2030 after some of these other identified projects are done, which is about what you guys have been spending since I've been here. You guys have been doing about a $200,000-ish water main project every other year. So that's probably reasonable to assume that that's gonna continue in some fashion. The sewer system side, the wastewater treatment plant improvements are the big one. Right now they're estimated at $5.6 million. You know, time frame, we just say 1 to 3 years. Some of that is indicative of when development's to come. We know the Southside Sewer Extension, which is number two there, there's definitely interest in that happening sooner than later, extending sewer service to that area. And that cost was $1.6 million about to do that. And that one, you know, there are different ways to handle that, and that's not necessarily addressed in here, but, you know, you could set up special service areas or things like that where some of those capital improvements will be borne by those people alone rather than the whole community. And then Elizabeth Street Lift Station and Watson Street Lift Station are both on here. I think ERH's quote last year was around $100K to basically retrofit it with the chopper pumps. I just put up to $300K if we do a full replacement and actually bring the controls and everything up to ground level where you're not working on all the equipment 15 feet underground, have confined space entry all the time. Watson Street, same way. I kind of put it on there as if we're going to start addressing these, it may be worthwhile to do both of them, get all that safety concern out of there. And then again, same as the one before, projecting out to, you know, beyond where these are needed, you know, based on the age of your guys' systems, the amount of mains and everything you guys operate, if you guys start doing some of that inspection that we talked about, you'll probably identify some other projects where maybe it makes sense to come in and do a lining project, or you need to do another lift station replacement sometime before the next 20 years. Basically, what that takes in, that takes into account all these potential things where you may or may not have them, but ideally you want to have that money to be able to do these programs. A lot of people are getting to the point, and your guys' system's 50 years old, it's probably reasonable to assume that you guys could do some lining projects to, you know, eliminate some of this inflow infiltration that we are seeing and address some things proactively rather than reactively. I said biannually starting in 2029, so that's essentially how I did that, is I set that up in a fashion that one year you do a water project, one year you do a sewer project, so that you weren't trying to do too much in one year, but it may be different when you actually get there. A note on the water system, distribution system mapping is desired, not considered capital improvement right now. It is right now lumped into the project proposal for moving forward with this stuff. And then the annual sewer cleaning inspection is also not what I would consider a capital project, but it's probably a good O&M best management practice to budget for. So sequencing alternatives of how we're going to implement these capital improvements. You know, step one is pay as you go. You know, once you have the money in the bank, you can do the project. Number two is long-term financing. We really looked at IEPA because I think they're the best fit for this right now. You do have eligibility for principal forgiveness right now. That does change year in and year out. They have a very low interest rate. You guys are currently eligible for about 75% of the market rate for up to 30 years financing. And on the water side, the current fiscal year's program is 60% principal forgiveness up to $800,000. So essentially, right now, I think we have about $1 million worth of projects outside of miscellaneous future main projects. You know, basically, you'd be getting that for about 40% of the cost if you were submitted and got the 60% principal forgiveness. On the sewer side, you're eligible for up to 15% principal forgiveness. And although that can change year to year, unless something drastically changes with that program, I think you got that 15% should stay steady, because right now that is solely based on your population, whereas the other one is based on your population and your unemployment rate, which is just slightly higher than the state's right now. I didn't take the principal forgiveness into account because I wanted to be a little bit conservative in this, to say, you know, if we don't get the stuff, we don't want to bank on it, we want to be able to take care of this regardless. So if you do get the principal forgiveness, everything's way better. So looking at rate adjustments as you go, this is probably too small to see, but essentially the key to get some of these done in a somewhat timely fashion on the water side, you'd be looking at a 25% increase next year, followed by a 10%, and then after that you'd be back to more of a cost of living adjustment for the remaining years. I plugged in 3% at this time for that. I know you guys have your ordinances 5%, and then you guys can discuss it and vote on it. Now on the sewer side, it's much more challenging just because some of these big ticket items right at the front end of this stuff, you would basically end up having to increase 25% each of the next, I think, 6 years, and then 5% a few years after that, and then you get back to what I would consider a normal cost of living adjustment. And you could, in a perfect world, you could basically get there, get your plant built, and then reduce your rates way back down, but that usually doesn't happen. So once you get your rates up somewhere, you usually don't cut them by 50%, which would be the way to do that if you were going to do it. And there's just highlighting some of those numbers I said. And then here's just kind of a bar chart to show the effects of you guys in this scenario of a pay-as-you-go versus the mean average of those, all the communities we looked at it before, and project them out with a cost of living adjustment through the years. But you can see you guys trend very closely to that, within about 2%, about 2% higher than that if you want to do pay-as-you-go for your water side. For your sewer side, you can see it's not so pretty. So the mean average right now is just a little under 40, and if you project that out at 3% per year, you can see within about 7 or 8 years, you're way above that, almost double in some situations. And really, after the downfall of this is that it's going to push off some of those big things like your wastewater treatment plant and possibly like the sewer extensions and some of the bigger projects out 7, 8, 9, 10 years, possibly to a point that you have more risk of critical failures happening there. This is a long-term financing option. Much more easy to stomach, I think. You'd be looking at a 10% increase over each of the next 3 years on the water side to fund the improvements that we've talked about, and then 10% increase over the next 4 years on the sewer side, and then a 5% increase up through year 20. Basically about another 10 years at 5%, which is what your guys' ordinance is built on, and then back to a cost of living adjustment from there on out. Not so bad. So here's the comparison here. You guys would trend slightly under some of those other communities' mean average, about 5% moving forward on the water side. And then on the sewer side, you'd actually trend significantly lower by financing these things out. And I should state, based on my assumptions, that the water side was financed over 20 years, whereas the sewer was 30 years. And I just did that because I didn't think that there was enough need to finance over 30 years. You certainly could and lower that down some more, but we aren't talking about the same dollars on the water side that we're talking about in the sewer. So sewer is projected over 30 years. And you can see ultimately in year 2040, you'd be about 7% less than that mean average still. And this would also allow you to get some of these bigger projects done in a timely fashion so that you're not increasing that risk of critical failure. So basically, the recommended capital project sequencing and rate adjustment is, we would recommend pursuing the IEP long-term financing. I think there's a lot of upside to it. Benefits that we notice is it's going to minimize impacts to your annual water and sewer rates. There's potential for the sprinkler forgiveness, which I think about 15% on the sewer side is going to be pretty steady, it seems like, at this point, whereas the water side right now, it would be great if we can get in that and get some things done at 60% principal forgiveness. Principal forgiveness really just is a grant, just what EPA calls it. And it allows the improvements to be completed as needed in a timely fashion rather than pushing them off down the line and waiting to build up funds for this stuff. You know, what are the next steps? So the question, you know, comes to, you know, does the village want to commit to performing these capital improvements and proper operation maintenance tasks to keep both these systems in a good condition? If yes, the village wants to proceed with the completion of capital improvement project plans required by EPA to apply for funding. We've got proposals in that we brought in last month's meeting, basically to take all of this information, compile it into a report that the IEPA requires to pursue financing, which includes looking more at some demographics and projecting some more present worth analysis out for long terms. Basically doing some more additional financial planning on this stuff. You know, if no, the question would be, you know, if you guys don't want to own and operate and maintain this stuff, or you don't want to, you know, look at making the increases, is the village interested in, you know, requesting proposals from people that would maybe want to come in and own and operate this stuff rather than your current setup? Basically, and then the last point there is just talking about the two proposals. Right now, task order 5 for the water system capital improvements project plan. Budget is $29.5, but that also includes, basically we would come in and do GPS mapping of your water system, which I know Matt wants. We looked at a few different ways of trying to skin that cat at this point. But right now that would be included there. And again, if you do get funded on the water side, the project plan itself is also eligible for that 60% principal forgiveness as reimbursement. The task order 6 is the wastewater system capital improvements plan. It's at $28.5, and that one's just a little bit more robust because we've got a little bit more planning and larger scale projects to go through and identify on that. Questions?
that information.
And I've got on that jump drive, I did put the PowerPoint on there as well, so if you guys want to go back through and take it in. And the reports are all on there as well. I left a couple hard copies here too for anybody that wants to go through any of that. You guys, if you need to get a hold of Terry or me, this is our contact information, it's also there. You know, even if you got some burning question about something here that you don't think of now, but later on is annoying you, feel free to contact us. So, you know, basically, right now, EPA's fiscal year, if you guys do plan to proceed with the project proposal plan, basically that would, I think, is it June or July that recycles? It's June or July?
July 1st.
They'll have an intended use plan out, I think May-ish, that'll kind of say, this is what we think next year's plan is going to be, so come May, we can look at that and see, you know, are we going to still make the 60% next year? Is it going to be 60%? I mean, between last year and this year, the water took a major hit because it went from 75%, was it? Oh, it was 1.5 million, it was low max, down to 800,000. So, talking to Gary Bingham over there, he kind of indicated he doesn't see that being a huge change, but you guys are so close on the cusp of the water side right now because of the unemployment rate credentials, that it may or may not be there next year. And realistically, if we do this project plan, we're probably looking at submitting closer to late spring, so this is going to get in the 2021 fiscal year plan.
It takes about a year to get through the Illinois EPA's facility planning approval process.
Okay. Any other questions, guys? Nothing? Good presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Probably gets pretty long, so I apologize for that.
No, it was great.
It was great.
It was great.
You know, digest it. It is a lot. If you have questions, feel free to contact.
No pun intended on that digest.
Remote receiver.
It is.
Whatever you guys got, just let us know and we'll get you answers.
There you go. Perfect. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
I think on, there's a lot to look at and stuff, but I think on the next agenda meeting, it's kind of a no-brainer on the water, but sewer is, I mean, there's a lot to think about on it. It's a lot of money. It's big money. So any questions or comments on anything before we, you guys have any in the gallery? Do you have any questions?
Do you have someone in the village that is really proficient in grant money, or?
So we're going to use these guys for.
Unfortunately, the grants right now, really for this type of stuff, the three options that I see that are out there regularly are IEPA, USDA, and CDBG. CDBG funds are very competitive. You guys just, but frankly, make too much money here to be considered for those. You have to have a pretty high ranking on what they call the low to moderate income levels, which it's pretty tough. I mean, even communities that hit, they require 51%, even the ones that are hitting 51% aren't even getting funded because there are people out there hitting 80% getting it. The USDA is one right now, they're operating on 2010 census data. And I think based on what I have read there, you guys are already not necessarily capable of getting grant funded because of where your current rate structure is. General rule of thumb they look at is like a 1.5% of your median household income, which is about double what you guys are at right now. So it would be probably difficult to get grant funds to them. EPA right now, you're eligible on both sides. Water, you're right on the cusp. Sewer, I don't think that's going to change. Based on what I've heard, so 15% is better than no money. So,
what about general obligation bonds as opposed to a loan?
You can certainly look into those. I mean, I don't know that you're going to get the same value, and they're probably still going to want similar data to back this up. EPA and USDA reports that they want for this stuff really make you project it out so it shows the intent of the programs now versus what they were in the 70s. 70s when a bunch of people built their systems, they didn't have a longevity part of it built in. They said, we're going to pay to build the system, and then you're going to figure out how to take care of it. Well, now they make you put in the report, we're going to take care of it, here's how, you know, and show that you're going to finance this way, and your rates are going to, you know, be adjusted so that in 40 years you're not knocking on the door for more money. But yeah, it's certainly an option. I mean, some people, depending on the size of the projects, they'll go out financing through local banks. But it's the challenge of, you know, that percentage. Usually you're going to be seeing more of like a 5% rather than this 1.5%.
Yeah, I've had some clients that go on debt certificates, others that go on revenue bonds, some go on alternate revenue bonds, so it has the alternative if you can't make the payment, it goes on tax rolls. So there are other vehicles to do it. Sometimes I've seen, as Tim mentioned, a couple banks in the community step up and say, we want to finance this, and we'll do it for 3%, which is not as competitive as 2%, but there's a lot less hoops to go through when you go to the local bank and you're keeping everything, you know, in town that way. But so it just depends on what's available.
Anything else, guys? If we have nothing else, I need a motion.
Make a motion to adjourn.
A second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.